Hey everybody, this is Austin Craig, producer and host on Season 3 of The Journey. We're working on more great episodes for Season 4, but today's show is a bit different than our usual. In our last episode, we heard from Jason Lemkin, the founder and CEO of Saster. Jason's interview is very much like his career. It packs a lot of insight into a relatively short time. We wanted to share the whole interview with you today. Enjoy this conversation between Mission co-founder Ian Faison and Jason Lemkin. We'll be back with another full episode next week. So many exciting things are happening in the world of small business, but often what gets talked about are highlights. The overnight success stories, the billion-dollar IPOs, the massive exits. And just like your Instagram feed, it's not the whole story. Let's look deeper than the headlines and press photos into the real work of building something valuable and lasting. I love crazy success stories, don't get me wrong, but we all know what's more important than the destination is how you get there, the struggles you have to overcome, the insights you learn along the way. So that's what we're doing. It's raw, it's honest, and maybe it's exactly what you need to hear. I'm Austin Craig, and this is The Journey.
Welcome to The Journey. I'm Ian Faison, Chief Content Officer here at Mission.org, and we are at Saster HQ. Jason, what's going on?
Living the dream, like every day. I had the worst sales, head of sales I ever worked at. I asked him every day how I was doing. We worked together for 9 months. You know how much he closed? Zero. And I'd walk him every day. I'd say, Michael, how you doing? It'd either be living the dream or never better. So I just decided to adopt that as my answer to that question. Because if you could go 9 months and close $0 and be the happiest cat in a startup, then that's got to be the right answer, isn't it? Living the dream or never better.
I say living the dream all the time. Well, yeah. It's like, you know, I guess if you're having fun doing it, but that's so
never, bad. Not a single, the pipeline kept growing, but literally he never closed a single deal, but never better, living the dream.
Pipeline kept growing. So we're going to get into to your background, and we're going to do a bunch of stops along the way of your journey. I want to know, when you were growing up, was there ever the first inkling that you were going to be an entrepreneur?
You know, I think all of us actually, if we tack back in time, we find little inklings, but there's generational changes, right? I mean, I certainly couldn't do what the Collision Brothers did and start Stripe back at that age. Not only am I not as smart as them, but the internet and APIs and technology were not as mature. So, I mean, boy, this is going, I've never done this on a back in time, you know, but when I was 13, I had an online hacking business that was doing about $3,000 a month.
What?
Yeah, in cash. When I was 13. But that wave ended. This was too early in technology. So, and I learned a little bit about that, and it stayed with me even through gaps growing up with and without technology and internet. And if I hadn't had that experience in my youth, I don't think I could have been an entrepreneur. And you see a lot, you know, people talk a lot about kids and games and stuff, but you learn, right? It takes a couple of years to learn. If you're going to be a Mark Zuckerberg or something, yeah, he started Facebook at what, 18 or 19?
Yeah.
But it was like the third product he started.
Yeah.
He started when he was 13. So you got to get inspired from something. So I guess I didn't realize that was entrepreneurship, was sort of selling hacking credentials when you're 13 for $3,000 a month. But it was enough of a spark that later in life, I had the confidence to quit a high paying job with nothing else to do and start my journey.
So what was your job before you were doing that? Were you 12 years old and just thinking like, hey, I want to start something? What was that
no,
like?
No, that's just what all kids do, playing around on a computer and then figure out how they can make money. My entrepreneurial moment, it was before I was a founder, but the first startup I joined, I was a startup lawyer on Sand Hill Road for 22 months. I was pretty bad at it. I didn't have the attention to detail to be a lawyer remotely, but I did all early internet companies, and the CEOs loved me because I had this passion for startups. And then one day I was walking in a parking lot on Sand Hill Road, and a very famous venture capitalist came up to him. I'd been practicing law for 22, I wasn't even two years in. And he said, I want to give you all my clients. That's pretty good, less than 2 years in,
yeah.
Right? To bring in one of the most legendary VCs in the day. And I went to my boss and I quit that afternoon.
Why'd you quit?
I realized that I had the passion for working with CEOs and the passion for startups, but I didn't want to be in the services business. And that was the first moment where I could bring in a client, right? Where I could turn this job, which had its pros and cons, but wasn't all bad. You know, I got to do IPOs and mergers and acquisitions and great experience. But then I realized what the business side of a of a legal business was, and I couldn't have it. Like I saw my life flash before my eyes, and like, yes, bringing in your first bigger client is exciting in before your second year, but I couldn't have it. So I quit that afternoon, had nothing to do. And then the next Monday, one of the companies I'd worked with that I incorporated offered me a job to be their head of business development and corporate development in a nice coincidence. So I joined my first web startup, and kind of that's where it started for me.
So did you know that company before?
Yeah, I'd incorporated. I'd known them since day one. I didn't know there was a job there. But, you know, I don't believe in karma, but I do believe that if you give it 110% and you help as many great people as you can, things work out for you over time. So I didn't have a job. I quit without any job, but I met the president of this company the next Tuesday for coffee. And he's like, well, we were thinking, would you join us? I'm like, well, good news. I'm free. As of Friday, I got no job. So I joined this company called Baby Center, and we went through a ride. A couple weeks later after I joined, Amazon offered to buy us for $300 million.
Woo!
A couple weeks. And then we signed a term sheet. And then another company, the VCs went behind our backs and kind of twisted our arms, and we sold to another company for $1 billion 5 weeks into this job. But that company then IPO'd and then was bankrupt within 14 months. So that was my first learning of having it all, having a lot of paper money, losing everything, you know, going in your 20s from the $300 million offer to the billion, to having $12 million in paper money, to having zero. So that was like my first 6 months of startup life.
Did it drive you crazy that when you were a lawyer working on with all of those companies that you were being billing them hourly? Because I would imagine looking back on it now, you're like, gosh, that's just so brutal for those startups. And it's like, I know it's something for like a lot of my friends who are lawyers. They just really struggle with it.
Well, first of all, times have changed. We were pretty early in working with startups, so our fees were cheap. And we took equity. So we had 2% in Yahoo and we had 2% of a lot of other companies. So there was it was very, very early in this hybrid play. And so the rates were low. But I did. I loved it. So I was the second highest billing attorney in the whole firm. But really, I was the first. And I just like wrote off like 20% of my hours.
Because
I just wanted to have the experience. Right?
Yeah.
You can't work with someone that raised $500,000 from Sequoia Scout and send them a $100,000 bill. You just your relationship will be broken. So it's like anything in SaaS and cloud or anything, you have to build relationships. And if you have to give a little bit on the beginning, it's worth it, isn't it?
It's funny because some of my friends that do that sort of stuff, or they're kind of pro bono, especially they're just like the early stage founders. They're like, you will get in so much trouble if you like, I remember one of the early lessons was the, turns out each email is a fractional percentage of time.
Yeah.
And you get that bill for $1,700 and you're like, wait, that was one email. What just happened?
And like most things, if you do well, it sort of works itself out. And, startups an interesting term. Startups have to grow quickly to be startups, right? And so if you invest in folks in the early days, and I'll tell you another story on the other side, I'll tell you the story when I bought Salesforce. But if you invest early, and if you don't bill them for the first 6 months and they're a rocket ship, they can afford the 10 grand a month later.
Yeah.
But I remember a fast forward story, if it's of interest. When I was starting EchoSign, my last company before Saster, and investing in everything I'm doing, I needed to learn how Salesforce worked because we built one of the first Salesforce integrations.
Yep.
And I needed to buy 2 seats. And I think Salesforce was like $40 per seat. So it was like $80 a month. And they wouldn't let me put my credit card in. I couldn't find anywhere on this website in 2006 to put my credit card in. I had to talk to sales. And I called up the sales rep and I said, I feel guilty. I only got $80 a month. I'm a waste of your time. He's like, no, we're going all in at Salesforce. We want to invest in these customer relationships. I'll spend all the time in the world you need to be a successful Salesforce customer. And just so you know, I'm compensated to do that.
Wow.
So he helped me get my 2 seats. He gave me some Salesforce training and helped get us live on their AppExchange partner program. Right.
Wow.
So invest. Like that's something. Now, I don't think Salesforce can do that today.
No, they can't. It's funny. I mean, obviously, and they're the sponsor of this show, but yes. I'll caveat that with the fact that like I was a Salesforce customer in my previous company. When we founded Mission, I was like, from Jump Street, I want everything in Salesforce.
Yeah.
But I was like, we can't afford, $125 a month per seat for Sales Cloud. It was right when Essentials had come out, $25 a seat. And it was like, boom, we're getting a seat. It was like first thing. And it's like one of those classic kind of startup problems where you're like, have to think like a big company. And I was like, I know that right this second I can do it on a Google Sheet, but in 3 years from now, I want all of that information to have from day one. I want all of our customer relationships to be managed. And if they're not, it's like switching in a year and a half is going to be way more painful than
there's pain. Debt issues that you're addressing. But what Salesforce knew in that story when I bought in 2006 that most of us entrepreneurs didn't know, that came from the next generation. Mark knew that, because he knew this from Oracle, he knew that the customers lasted decades if you treated them right.
Yep.
Most of my generation, guys that started with me, Aaron Levy, we were new to SaaS, all these other folks, you know, the Drew Housens, the David Sachses, the folks that were of my generation, of which I was the least successful of the successful. I had a good exit. I had a nine-figure exit. I did well, but they all did better than me. But none of us knew. None of us knew that these customers would last decades. But Mark had this superpower, and that let him invest that sales rep's time. He probably had to pay the sales rep like 200% of my deal commission. But he knew that like that startup might grow to 100 seats and 1,000 seats. And importantly, if that customer lasted 20 years, the real dollar value of that 2 seats could be incredible. Calculable, right? And the word of mouth. I tell all the startups I work with to use Salesforce. So I, out of that $80, I may have created $5 or $6 million of revenue for Salesforce. If you have this net negative churn, positive revenue retention in SaaS and cloud, you have to think in decades for these customers, and you have to go as long as you possibly can, because you'll never lose them if you treat them right. That's crazy.
When I heard about the fact that Salesforce sells with like prime and co-primes and all this sort of stuff, and I was talking to my buddy and he's like, oh yeah, no, you just both get the commission. I was like, you mean split the commission? You're like, no, you just both get it. Yeah. The prime AE owns it. They get a commission. And then also whatever that other business is, they also get it. And I was like, it like blew my mind at the time. I'm like, but that's so much out the door on commission. And he was just like,
yeah, you just got to get it done. Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like that sort of stuff is great. When did you kind of first start realizing that with EchoSign, that it compounds, that all this stuff compounds, that
between signing and closing the acquisition documents.
Oh my gosh.
It's true. We sold right when we got to $1 million a month, $12 million a year, growing over 100% with 140% revenue retention, and we were profitable. So if you're going $10 million, now let's just stop. That's 2011. Like it's a long time ago and none of us knew this. Just let's just do some math. If it's 2011 and you're doing $1 million a month, $12 million a year, and you're growing 100, you have 140% revenue retention. That means if you don't sell anything, you will grow 40%.
Yeah.
Right? Add some salespeople. We're already growing 100% and we're profitable. So we don't even have existential funding risk. How much, if you just draw a line at how much we'd be doing today, you want to know?
How much?
A little over 300 million. Okay. Even under Adobe, where it's been deprioritized, it's still doing nine figures of revenue. Okay. I didn't get it. Aaron Levy didn't get it. David Sack, the next generation all got it. Okay. The Stuart Butterfields and everyone gets this today, and the Eric Wands all get it. But it was just too early. We had this, we still knew these Web 1.0 companies that were flash in the pans. We saw consumer stuff go up and down too fast. We thought these were fickle. We thought that these things would go away. We didn't realize that enterprise software lasts decades. So, and also it's hard to be a CEO. My biggest mistake, I made so many mistakes as a CEO and I'm making them again today, but the number one mistake I make looking back with clarity is I didn't have a good enough mentor.
Yeah.
I didn't have a good enough coach or advisor. I felt like I was doing terribly at $1 million a month, growing over 100% with 140% revenue retention. I literally felt every day like I was doing terribly. I felt like, wow, well, that Aaron Levy guy is doing so much better than me. And that Drew Houston guy I met at the party is doing so much better than me. And like, what happened with like Groupon and all these companies? They're like exploding in a week.
Yeah.
And did you see the Facebook movie where he turned down $1 billion? I'm like, I felt like I was failing every single day. And it wasn't until between signing and closing the acquisition, I could breathe for a minute, right? And I sat back and I said, holy cow, let me look at this. If we do nothing, we'll get to 100 million. Nothing. But I literally did not have the presence of mind to see that. And so I've written 3,000 articles on Saster and done 5 years of Saster annuals to teach people this basic concept that it compounds. And that was actually the first Saster article we wrote. It's actually the second, was how it compounds. And I wrote this in 2012 and everyone was like, wow, he's right. It got like retweeted 1,000 times. Like no one in 2012 really viscerally understood that it compounds. But fast forward 6 years, Wall Street loves this stuff because we realize it's do it right. It's an annuity for decades, like for decades. But I didn't realize this until I had the presence of mind. So my number one bit of advice to founders that have anything is just relentlessly seek out one or two great advisors and mentors. You don't need 20. It's too much advice. You can get that on the internet, right? Frankly, listen to podcasts like this. It's better advice than the average 19th investor on your biased investor that sort of was a success. But every year you need some person to just really show you, especially where you're doing well. It's so easy. Every founder knows where they're failing. You do not have to tell a founder where they're failing, right? I was just at a board meeting with a company just crossed 10 million ARR that I love. And one of the investors, one of the smartest people I know, just kept telling the CEO where he was failing for 2 hours. I'm like, dude, he knows. You think he doesn't know that this metric is softer than this metric? Do you think he doesn't know that this particular resource is not as strong as this other? You think you know everything that's failing at your company, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, every founder with more than an 80 IQ knows, but it's hard to see when you're doing well, when every month you got to like put up new sales. Every month you have to grow faster than the last month. Every quarter has to be better, right? And that's the hard part of these businesses is, especially in SaaS, is like, yeah, the business recurs, but those dials in Salesforce, they go back to zero at the start of each quarter.
Yeah.
Right? You start at zero and like, okay, I did 100K last quarter. Now I got to do 125. Now I got to do 150. Now I got to do 200. And it's exhausting. Right? That part never gets easier, is that each quarter you have to do better than the last one, right? And you need a coach to tell you, you know what? You just crossed 10 customers. You've got a couple six-figure customers. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Take a break.
It's funny. I was recently listening to something they were just talking about, or maybe it was an interview that we were doing. They're just talking about, with the CMO of SurveyMonkey with Leela, and they were talking about NPS and just how SurveyMonkey helps you get NPS and all that sort of stuff. And she was just saying, you know, like kind of flippantly, like, hey, it's your North Star metric. And I was like, wait a second, that is the North Star metric. And I like kind of went back, and so we did an NPS survey for our customers, our 7 customers at the time. Yeah. And an NPS of 100%. We're like, oh, wow, that makes you feel better.
It does.
Because you're like, yeah, every day you're just like drowning in a million other things. And like just simple things like that, that give you clarity or insight into your how your customers feel about you, is like, oh my goodness, that's what's important, right? Like, oh, do these people that are paying money for us actually care? Did you ever feel like, you know, that kind of the butterfly's wing scenario, that maybe you wish you had never sold, but if you had never sold, then it wouldn't have created everything that Sasser has become?
You know, these are interesting questions. If you read like a lot of Justin Kahn's tweets and what he's doing with Atrium, I feel like he's more successful founder than me, but he's like, all the founders I knew are like Airbnb. They're all worth 20 billion. I only sold for $1 billion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was at an event with him. I'm asked, are you a little haunted by that? Would you have founded Atrium and done all this if you weren't haunted? He's like, yeah, I probably wouldn't have done Atrium and all of this. So Silicon Valley, I believe, exists exactly where we're doing this podcast. It's within several miles of Soma, but it's also all across the world. It's this mindset, and it comes with, it drives us to greatness. And I believe it's inherent to Silicon Valley, wherever you are in the world, it's a positive sum game. You have to believe it's a positive sum game. We're not Wolf of Wall Street or whatever, but we also are constantly, we have this search for knowledge. So we have to compare ourselves to everyone else. So it is hard. You have to do the butterfly effect or the path not taken. And in recurring revenue, it's easier than any other path. Like it's very easy for me to say, look, when I sold EchoSign, the entire market for electronic signatures was 50 million. That was the TAM. Okay. And I know that exactly. And I know what it is today. It's 1.6 billion. Now we had 28% revenue market share and 34% transaction market share. So it's 28% times 1.6 billion. What is it? That's what we'd be doing. And we were gaining market share, not radically, but a little bit. So 28 times 1.6 billion, that's the good and bad of recurring revenue. You know, right? You know. And it'll be fun in a couple of years to see what the Jody Bonsels from AppDynamics and the Ryan Smiths from Qualtrics, which had insane exits. But while these companies were accelerating, what do they think?
Yeah.
I mean, Ryan Smith selling Qualtrics for 8 billion sounds crazy. But what if in 5 years, Medallia is worth 25 billion?
Yep.
Right? Jody Bonsall selling AppDynamics for $3.7 billion sounded crazy, but what's New Relic worth today? What's Datadog going to be worth?
Yeah,
Datadog be worth $15 billion. And I love Jody and I love AppDynamics, the whole story. It's just many of us will be tortured forever almost on this, right? And the ones that aren't, I've all moved to South Beach. I'm not kidding. There's a whole diaspora in Miami, principally because the taxes are a lot better than Florida. You can see a lot of Uber folks and others. They're there. They're happy. Right.
That
but if
so
you're here
funny.
In the Bay Area, I don't think you can ever be happy in Silicon Valley. Not truly happy. But you can be on an incredible journey, like the best journey of your life with the best people and the best relationships. And that's what I love every day. But that South Beach happiness, you're not going to get here in Soma.
I mean, I will say this. There's no redwood trees in South Beach. So yeah. every time I feel weird about something, I just go hug a redwood.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like your SaaS founders that you work with? You've said this many times that they're all better than you were as a founder.
Which if I invest, they're better than me.
Yeah.
I invest, yeah.
And that, you know, you need to be better than kind of the people before you. Do you think that like being better and getting better every day is just part of the ethos of successful entrepreneurs?
I think all the great entrepreneurs constantly want to get better. I think that some of them think in those terms. Maybe the Peter Thiels and the David Sachs, the PayPal Mafia folks think literally in those terms. What I see a more diverse set of behaviors, though, that are consistent through all great founders I work with, which is, and this has downsides, especially as downsides for family. But the best founders I know, almost every hour of the week, including when they're on a run, in the shower, relaxing by the pool with friends, they're always thinking about how to make work better. They're always thinking about how to make that product better, how to tweak that feature, how to close that extra deal. Always, always. And that compounds. If you spend many of the best founders I know spend 30 hours a week in the office.
Yeah.
Right. I always felt like when we were doing a release, I'd be the last one out of the office. Okay. Cause I would always be the last one doing the last QA, the last functional QA. But if it was a normal day, I didn't want anyone to feel any pressure. Right. Yeah. I left at 6 o'clock, whether I turned my computer on at 7:30 at home, but I left, I wanted to not have that. But at everything I've done in my life that's entrepreneurial, if I'm lucky, there's been an hour a day when I haven't thought about what I'm building. Right. And it's wonderful, right? It compounds, but it's obsessive. And by trying to do better almost every hour of your waking life, you will do better. You will. As long as you have that level of commitment. And so if you can commit for a decade, if you can commit for 20 years, think about how that compounds, that commitment. It compounds.
I think it also compounds in your relationships. I think this is one of the things that I know for me personally, I have seen how few people really, really invest in relationships. And then when you have, you get to a point where you really need those and you can rely on them, how important it is. For example, we interviewed Megan Eisenberg, CMO at Trip Actions.
She's great.
She hired like 24 marketers in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Like, wonder why that is. And I asked her and she's like, yeah, I've been having coffee with people for years.
Yeah, for a decade and a half.
Yeah. Keeping up with everyone. How important were your early relationships, potentially before you created EchoSign, but specifically after?
We all have different stories. Megan, who is a rock star, she's a superstar recruiter. I consider myself a B-minus recruiter, maybe C+. I have strengths. And that's why I've written so much about having to spend 20% of your time recruiting.
Yeah.
That's why I enforce religiously the 30 interviews rule. You have to interview 30 VP candidates. Otherwise, you never interview enough. I come up with these rules because I'm not a great recruiter. And I suffer for it that's probably my biggest failing as a CEO is I don't spend half my time recruiting. What has saved me, it's just different than Megan. What has saved me is about once a year, hiring a very senior person that's amazing. That's just amazing. And I was watching a video that Steve Jobs did on YouTube the other day, and he said it takes him about 18 months to recruit a VP.
Oh,
Steve Jobs.
Goodness.
And this was at his peak, not his Apple peak, but this was his peak at Next, when every ex-Apple engineer wanted to work for Steve at Next. He said, he had his VP of marketing with him at this lecture at MIT, and it took him 18 months to hire his VP of marketing. And he's like, I'd rather just pass. And I hired the best VPs in the world and they bring their teams. And so that's my strategy. Even our little Saster, we hope to do $25 million in revenue here this year. I've got some of the same team that I worked back with EchoSign that are the best of the best. And if you can get, I wish I could recruit 100 people myself, but if you can recruit 3 incredible VPs that can then recruit, you can build a machine. But you need 3. Like if you're on your own, it's too hard. If you have one, you have someone to talk with at the end of the day. But if you have 3 of the VPs, they're never all going to be great. Everyone says they have the best management team in the world. They don't. But what you need is someone that cares more than just their 9-to-5 job or 9-to-8 job. Someone that will carry the load for you, right? Someone that will be almost a mini founder that will internalize your mission and journey. And if there's 3 of you, you're just unstoppable.
Did you ever find that there's like really low points in kind of your founder's journey where you wanted to give up or quit or just call it a day?
You mean how many weeks a year? Is that the question? including this year? Yes, all the time. And I think there's a moment, this is my feeling of not knowing between signing and closing, not having the clarity that we were unstoppable, right? That's why, you know, the second Sastry Annual in our book was called Impossible and Inevitable. I didn't realize this inevitability, right?
I was bringing it up. I freaking love that book. It's one of my favorite business books ever.
The second edition just came out. It's much better. So read the second edition. The first edition was cool for 2013, but the next one is, or 2015, the next one's much better.
Well, I read Predictable. Well, quick aside. Yeah. I read Predictable Revenue before I started selling. I just got out of the Army and I was just like, holy crap. Like, this is amazing. Like, this is like, oh, it all makes sense. Like, and then I read From Impossible and I was like, oh my goodness. So it's just, but it's like, you forget though, that things are at the cutting edge when you're like reading it, right? Yeah. Like I always think about, you know, like Lean Startup, for example, or Zero to One, or all these books that people, you know, tout all the time. It wasn't written that long ago.
Not that long ago.
But those are all post 2011. This is less than 10 years ago. Like all of those lessons are like barely being adopted. They just seem like they're mass adoption because you live in a bubble and stuff. But anyways, I digress. Sorry.
It's just what are everyone has different motivations. Maybe I'm not the best founder or CEO. For me, in the early days of both my startups, maybe even everything I've done at some level, is I just refuse to fail. It's not acceptable to fail. And I will tell you, I've done 23 investments in SaaS companies. My first group's up about 14x, overall about 8x. You know how? And this is not necessarily good for venture investing. Zero have failed. Okay, zero. I've just invested in founders better than me with 10 or more customers. Some of them may never make a dollar, but none of them have failed. And when I started with startups, I immediately was thrown into situations where for the first time, failure was likely.
Yeah.
Was likely. So that first startup I joined where we were acquired for $1 billion, you know, it was bankrupt within a year, right? Now eventually our unit got spun out and was part of Johnson & Johnson, still around, but that parent company was bankrupt. Like that was my first brink of failure, right? $12 million in paper money and then gone in failure. So then I joined this other startup. The startup had raised a ton of venture capital. It had $50 million in customer contracts and was about to raise another $30 million. So I joined the startup, and my second week, my boss and I go to Japan to meet the largest customers with these $50 million contracts. By the end of the first day, all the $50 million contracts were canceled. All of them. We went from 50 to $0 million in revenue. Then at the end of that week, the corporate investor pulled out. So we went from $50 million and $30 million revenue, my second week of this startup, to zero and zero, to no revenue and no capital. And I'm like, well, this is a lot different than I thought when the VCs connected me to this company. And I said, what am I going to do? I went back, I pulled together the management team. I mean, I was young. And I said, okay, we can't fail. What are we going to do? What are our strategic options? And really no one had any ideas. So first I sat down with the CEO and I said, we got to raise another $30 million, even though we have no revenue. So I went out, I brought in 150 VCs and we raised $30 million. Then I grabbed an engineer that was about to get laid off there that had done this R&D project to make these implantable batteries. And I said, could we sell these? And she said, maybe. So we went, and in the course of a month, we closed $6 million in customer contracts and then raised $9 million and spun this out and created our own company that we then sold for $50 million in 12 months. And like, these are like fun stories. I haven't even scratched the surface on some of these stories, but I just couldn't fail, right? And then I did this and we sold that company for $50 million. I was happy. I was making my wife smoothies. Like, I never thought I was good enough to be a founder. And, you know, everyone's a founder today. But I sold this company in 2004. No, I didn't know any founders in 2004.
Yeah. Right?
And everyone I knew from 2002 had gone bankrupt. So like, my co-founder and I, she and I were like the only successful founders I knew. So I was happy as a clam. I checked my box. I'd been a founder. I made a few nickels and I could let my wife's career grow. And then I kind of got cajoled by one of my co-founders into doing EchoSign. And we had a great team, but it was the first time in my life where we had just total founder disalignment, like conflict almost from the beginning. And 10 months later, one of my co-founders just walked out the door and never came back. And we had 5 months of money left. And we were doing about $800 a month in revenue.
Oh my gosh.
So he, in essence, quit, right? I mean, whether in his mind he quit, but when you walk out the door after you raise $2.5 million in capital, you're quitting, aren't you? So that was my first moment when, you know, I joined a startup that was about to fail. That went from 50 million in contracts and 30 million of venture to zero and zero. But I never, you know, this is my first time as a founder. I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I said, I just can't. I don't know if this will ever succeed, but it will not fail. Like, it will not fail by hook or by crook. So I went out, I closed Dell, I closed Comcast, I closed British Telecom, I closed GE Financial. I took no salary for a year. I reinvested some of the money I had for my first company to stretch the payroll and the cash reach. And right or wrong, I've just learned that if you're a better founder, if I went through these experiences, if you're better than me and you have 10 customers, you just won't fail. You just won't fail. I just came back today from a board meeting from some founders. I love these founders to death. And we just went through a rough period. It was very rough. And today they crossed $1 million in revenue. Like more than about tripling. And it was tough. I'm just like, there's just no way these guys are going to fail. She's such a great CEO. Her co-founder's great. And like, they're better than me. So like, it's going to be brutal. But if I got through that, the best ones will get through it. So anyhow, I learned that became my MO in the early days is just don't fail, right? And it has a downside, which is it can make you too conservative, right? So it was different times, but I built a $12 million SaaS business growing 100%. I only burned $5 million.
Wow.
Like that would be laughable today in cloud, right? Because we would raise like $100 million.
Yeah. Oh, wait.
So you have to be careful to not in startups, like, you know, every dollar does count in the early days and you do need to take out the garbage, but you have to be careful once you cross 4 or 5 million in revenue to not stay too lean.
Yeah. Right?
It can work for the Datadogs. It can work for the MailChimps. But it doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And the third investment I ever did is a company called Talkdesk. I invested in 2014, just one person in the US, five in Portugal. They didn't even have a desk. Now they're worth $2 billion and nine figures in revenue. And I was with the CEO when we did our Paris event a couple months ago, and he only raised one round. Okay, and I love Thiago like a brother, but he's a little cheap. But I love him. I love everything about the company. I asked him what his top mistakes were. Really the most capital efficient company I've been close to, right? Other than myself. He's like, I should have raised more money. Like it was too lean. It was too hard to build an enterprise sales team and to hire 200 enterprise sales reps without raising any money.
You know, it's funny you say that. We always talk about like leaving room for serendipity. And I think that that's one of the big things that early on, like you're so, and like, you know, I mean, maybe it's because our founding team has two army vets or something like that. So, you know, we run, you know, to a certain point, but I think a lot of founders, like, they just get so close-minded and focused, and like certain types of like buying ads or this and that. Like we ran this one ad that was like pretty, like super expensive for us at the time. And it was like, and we had 750 people apply to the company, and we're just like, holy crap. Like that's crazy. But like, you know, $800 at the time was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so
you hired someone for $800.
Yeah, exactly. Year? Yeah.
That's the best investment I've heard of this week.
Yeah, no, yeah. Exactly. And we had, and then, so we're like, hey, do we keep this thing rolling every month for $800, or every quarter? Gosh, it was so cheap, but it was one of those things like you take a look at that stuff, and you, especially when you come from a position of scarcity in your life, when your family never had money, when your co-founder's family never had money, when you don't operate from a position of abundance, like it's really hard to make those type of investments. And a lot of smaller businesses or growing businesses or startups, especially first-time founders, like it's sometimes really hard to part with money. Sometimes it's easier, but sometimes it's really hard.
That is hard. Most founders get through it. The mistake that a lot of folks make in cloud, the part that gets harder is playing dominant strategy. This is what happens. Because look, you have no money, you have nothing. The $800 was a lot, right? Then you build the business up to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 million. And you always end up with what I call a mini brand. Before your Salesforce, if you have 3 million of revenue and your product's, you know, whatever, $30,000 a year, you've got, what is that, 100 or 1,000? You've got 100 happy customers, or 1,000 if you're 3,000. Like people know you in a niche, right? Yeah. They know your brand. And you start to get really good at it. You start to get really good at the objections, the sales objections. You start to know as soon as that lead comes in and says, I need this sort of this podcast management software and it needs this certain integration, you know, you just won that deal. As soon as they say they need the Salesforce integration, whatever it is, and you get really good at it. And then you get comfortable around 8 or 10 million. You're like, you know what? I can win that deal and spend like a dollar and make $20. Or like I can go learn a new cloud. Like I can try to penetrate the Microsoft ecosystem. I don't know anyone there. There's like a really entrenched competitor and it's gonna cost me $10 for every $5 I make. Okay, lean startup, bootstrapping says don't do that. Dominant strategy, which works in cloud, which it says as soon as you can afford to do this,
You win every category, even the ones you lose, because you're ripping it away from your competitor. You're ripping it away. And if you want to win in many B2B categories, if you want to win in cloud and it's competitive, you really have to decide after a certain point in time if you want to play dominant strategy. And you look, sometimes folks raise hundreds of millions of dollars because they're capital inefficient or they have a brutally expensive go-to-market strategy. But sometimes if you squint, they're playing dominant strategy. And they're like, I'm going to win where I'm strong, and I'm going to win where I'm weak, and I'm going to win where they're strong and I'm weak. And that's how you kill the competition, is dominant strategy. You win in all four. You do a 2x2 matrix of like strong and weak, and you put a lot of money into weak and weak.
So I want to talk Sastr, because this is, it's a company that I've admired for a long time. I think, you know, you were so cutting edge at the time to obviously create it, but the idea of event, build a community, give content to that community, and then build a fund of the best people in that community, yeah, I think is just so brilliant.
Seems like it today.
Yeah, right? So, but I'm curious, you know, like those early days when you were like, am I really going to do this thing? Am I going down the founder deep dive again? Or yeah, am I doing the investor thing? Like, you know, I know you were an investor for a brief stint before you went full bore into Sastr. I'm just curious, like, how did you decide to make that jump?
I don't think I figured it out until January of this year. I didn't. It's tough. Sastr as a blog and some core answers started off as a cathartic experience for me after I'd sold my company and had left to share my learnings. And I was the first one of my generation of the Aaron Levy's and the David Sachs's and the others that had sold and didn't have to pretend anymore, didn't have to go IPO, had nothing to hide. And I needed to do this. I didn't care for myself. What I realized I needed to do was, because I'd sold too early, I wanted my team to feel like heroes. The truth is, which I probably have never written before, is I actually did Sastr for my team, so that my team would realize we did amazing things together. And if you squint in the early posts, there's a lot of that, of what a great team. And this is a team that's gone on to do many things, from being, you know, CRO of Brex and many other companies for the team, and Gong and lots of other great companies that like this, especially our revenue team spawned. And so I did this for myself and I didn't know. And then in 2013, but I sort of knew, because the first post I did, the second one was, it compounds that learning. And the first one was, everybody lies. Everyone exaggerates their revenue.
Yeah, totally.
And then I took the Inc. 500 list and I showed what the real revenue was for SaaS companies, because no one had IPO'd, right? And the first like I got was from Aaron Levy. So I'm like, okay, if Aaron likes it, I know, even if I'm on to something. But then I did a meetup in 2013, like 800 people came to the meetup, like just with no content, just to show up, right? And then, you know, after a year and a half, we did the first Sastr annual in 2015, and like it sold out. We had 1400 people come the first year, including the party. So then I just learned that this was some sort of, you know, I had some sort of lightning in a bottle. And this is the whole startup story. Like, this lightning in a bottle thing sounds trite, but if you've done startups for a long enough time, you've had that moment, right? Where you see lightning in a bottle, and it's just what it really, lightning bottle sounds trite, but it's really market pull. Like, why should one blog or one set of, Quora was designed to talk about movies and games. No one, I can tell you can talk to the founders of Quora, no one thought it would be used to promote SaaS answers.
Yeah,
like totally. It was a total unexpected use case for Quora. Like, I broke the whole model of what they thought content would be like on this platform, and we could chat about why. But that's like, when something starts to grow faster than you understand, like, you just got to find some way to lean in and feed it. Right. Because later the world catches up and things changes. I'm not the only person writing in 2019 about how to grow a business software faster.
No,
but like there's like 100 subreddits about this topic now. Right. And back in the day, there was only Sastr.
Yeah. But I think you were the most accessible. It's the same thing. We actually learned the same thing from Medium. Like, that's how we built the largest publication in Medium. We're doing 3 million uniques with a team of one, like just Chad, our founder. I mean, like, that was it.
Yeah.
And like, the reason was a lot of things that Chad knew intuitively about, like, what people were looking for on the platform. But it's something that, like, Medium definitely didn't think that was going to be the case.
Yep.
And they didn't know that those topics were going to be the things that resonated with people. And I think it's the same sort of thing. And I think, you know, it's about access. And this is one of, in my opinion, one of the brilliant things about Sastr is, like, the people were thinking these things and you brought them into the light from the darkness of, like, these were all of the insecurities and feelings and thoughts and, you know, the quiet discussions that were happening in basements in Silicon Valley and around the country of like, and around the world is like, am I even close?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, is this even the world that I live in? And then so when you put together a community around it that can now self-support each other, because you realize we're all in the same, we all have the same business model at Compounds, right? So we have that commonality. And then it's a matter of, hey, Jason helps out everybody. He answers everybody's questions. So like, we should probably help each other out. And I just, for me personally, I feel like that's what the community really provides.
Yes.
And it's something that when you also have an investment vehicle attached, that it's the logical next step, right? It's like, we have to find the best founders and invest in those.
Yeah. I mean, actually, that's, we could break it up into two pieces. I mean, I think you're right. It's a good insight, which I hadn't thought about till you brought it up. I think if you think of Saster as at least putting in 99 pieces of value before you take a chip out,
yeah.
Like not nine, but 99, you know, and I think, and then I look at these case studies, you know, folks like, you know, Lucerne and Jeff Lawson and Eric Wan talking about how they learned this stuff from Saster. It's not that the content was so novel. I mean, you know, all this, you know, a lot of this stuff now, right?
Yeah.
But creating this community where everyone feels like they'll take some knowledge and they'll give it back at the, I mean, it's really crazy, right? But I think you're right. By giving so much in, we can get all these folks to come to our events and everything else we do and give back unilaterally. Right. No commercials, no paid content, no anything allowed. Right.
Well, the other thing, too, is that it's a non-vendor focused platform.
Yes.
Right. So like that's another key point of this is like you didn't have a point of view on a certain way that the future was going to exist. You just said SaaS is going to be really important. So let's build some stuff around it. I'm curious, like what were kind of your early inklings of like where the heck this stuff is going?
I didn't know. I remember when I briefly worked at someone else's venture capital firm from 13 to 15, when I started, I made a whiteboard and I'm like, how quickly do you need to grow in 2013 to be an investable company? I didn't know the answer. I'm like, at a million in ARR, should it be 8%, 10%, 12%? I did a whiteboard. I didn't know. And then I met Pipedrive. They were at a million. Now they're at basically nine figures in revenue. They're at a million, growing like 12% a month. I'm like, I think that's fast enough. I don't know. Let's invest in that one. And then I did Talkdesk and Algoy and a few others, all of which grew at the outlier rates. I don't think I knew. I didn't think I knew the answers to any of these questions. We have so much more data now. We've had like 49 cloud IPOs. Now we know how everybody's doing.
Yeah. I think that it's a great point of like what the IPOs even looked like back then. Like IPOing, what's the Opsware, LoudCloud, they were doing like—
Well, LoudCloud was Opsware. I get confused. I think it's the same company.
Yeah, right? It's the same company. Yeah. But yeah, they were just like $50 million in revenue or something like that when they IPOed. And so it's like the whole market completely changed since that happened, right? So it's
AWS is 10 times larger than it was in 2013. Loudware and OpsCloud, whatever it was, Ben Horowitz and MacroGenesis, that was like seven clouds ago. Okay.
Yeah.
They were trying to do something way early, right? Pre-everything, pre-AWS, pre-containers, pre-everything. But cloud actually didn't really take off till like 2013. Like I feel like it's crazy that we sold so early, but the truth is no one knew in 2011 and even 2012. And then 2013, the cloud just picked itself up and just ran right up the hill. That locomotive just ran up the hill. And there's a couple reasons for it. But one thing none of us predicted was, you know, there's about $1 trillion in annual IT software spend. And we didn't really realize that how quickly another 10% of that would go to cloud. And 10% of $1 trillion is an extra $100 billion. And so think how many SaaS companies can do $1 billion. Twilio's doing $1 billion now, right? If there's room for another 100 Twilios, right? That's a lot of spend. And none of us foresaw that change would happen, that it would accelerate around 2013. But every CIO, every global company said, we need to innovate. We need to innovate in the cloud and SaaS. And they just moved massive amounts of money. We can call it on-prem, but they just moved massive amount of money from old software to new software, which was cloud. And they did it faster than they've ever done in the history of enterprise software. And it caught all of us unprepared.
I'm curious too about just like business models of like so many of the principles that you teach that are taught now of just like, you know, sell directly to your customer, maintain a direct relationship with your customer as quickly as possible, do all these things, add on services, you know, spend what I love is someone was saying this the other day that when they came on as CMO, they shifted 80% of the marketing or marketing dollars to like post sale, where they're like, everything is about retaining.
Customer marketing.
Yeah. Everything is about customer marketing. I'm just, you know, it seems like companies now, specifically technology companies, have such a different relationship with the customer than they ever have.
Maybe.
Ooh, all right.
I mean, I don't know. I look at like Adobe. When I was at Adobe, the stock price is 30. Now it's at 300. you know, the person that made the most on my team was my CTO because he just stayed. And I look at Adobe, which is wildly successful, right? $100, $200 billion market cap today. It's the same software. It's Photoshop. it's Creative Cloud instead of Master Collection. A lot of that software is downloaded. Now the collaboration's much better with the internet, but it's paying a monthly subscription. I mean, do you really have a different relationship with Photoshop today as you did in 2011? I'm not sure.
Right? But I will say though, as someone who creates content for a living, that it is a huge thing that we look at with companies like Canva and things like that now, where you're like, it is a decision point now. And it probably never was a decision point. And you can kind of cobble together stuff, or you can just do Audition and these other things. So I would say, though, that now with their collaboration suite, but either way, you're totally right. It's like that is the most clear pain point for anyone who wants to make things.
But I don't think Canva, and I love Canva, and Melanie's going to be at the SaaS Triennial. I use Canva every week, okay? But I don't think I have a different relationship with Canva, who I've never talked to a human being there, than I do at any predecessor products.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, I don't think this web has enhanced our customer relationships, not our the human side. I don't know. In fact, I think in some ways they've made them retrograde. I've interviewed 30 customer success professionals the last month, both for Saster and for some other companies. And I've been shocked how many seasoned veterans I have do not want to talk to the vast majority of the customers they manage. They want to handle it through automation. They're like, I'll go meet a couple of my customers and I'll talk to my top 10, but the rest I all want to do through automation. And that's great that there's incredible customer success tools that allow that automation, but that's moving away from the classic knock on the door and check how your customer's doing. This is moving away from the country doctor who knows everybody in town. So I don't know that the web has made business software a closer connection with the customers. I don't know that that's true. And if it is, I think we're very early in the journey.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And I would say that, you know, your advice rings true here of like, get on the plane, right? Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we very early on as a customer were like, you know, for us, and we're selling enterprise, so it's a different thing, but massive contracts that have millions of integration points to lots of different places, like the more complex the sale, you need to have a relationship if that's what your business model, you know, needs. I would say the other side.
You need a relationship if the customer is making a multi-year bet on you.
Yeah.
They need to know not just what the product does today, but what the team and the product under it are going to deliver for the next 5 years. That's what they need to know. They're making a bet. They're making a big bet for years and years and years. And that's a much riskier. It's like being a VC and never meeting the founder. Like, you can do it. Like, it happens. But it's hard to write a $10 million check as a VC and never meet the founder. You can make a $50,000 check. But it's super risky, right?
We have 3 minutes left. I want to ask you a few questions just on kind of like some little different, more fun stuff. What's a question that you never get asked that you wish you were asked?
Can family truly come first with a startup that's all consuming? And I think that this is something that most founders don't talk about, but I think it's important. And I think your family always can come first. You can, if it's important to you to be home at 6 o'clock for dinner with the family and kids, you can make that happen. Okay. You can move that flight around. You can architect your startup so that at 5:59 lights go out. Okay. You can do that. You can be home. You can be at the soccer game. You can be at the first day of school. I was at the first day of school. But if you're thinking every waking moment about your company, you're never going to be present with your family the same way as you are with your startup. You'll never be present the same way. And a derivative question is, you know, like, what changes as a founder? And I've learned that, like, after a couple of years, family can never really always be first in the same way you want it to be. And after about 4 to 5 years, your brain changes. And you no longer can go back. You no longer can go to Miami Beach and just hang out with your kids. Yeah. You no longer. When I sold my first startup for $50 million, it was after 12 and a half months. I went right back to old mode. It was great. I was happy. I was so happy after I sold my first company. I bought my wife a sports car. I made her smoothies. I got in good shape. I was, because I hadn't really become my brain had not changed in 12 and a half months. After I sold the second time was after 5 years. That year I took off after EchoSign and before I started whatever, Saster investing, it was my most miserable year. I bought my wife a car again, but I smashed it up. Okay, I was I wasn't just depressed. I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back to that not building something constantly, not thinking all the time. And so there are these trade-offs for entrepreneurship, and there's this intensity of something consuming you every waking hour, and it's how we build these great things. But there are trade-offs in terms of family and brain that I think that, you know, a few years ago it didn't matter, everything was new. But as we're all thinking in terms of decades in cloud companies, it's kind of a quiet conversation that I think founders should be able to have with each other, right? How do you handle this? How do you handle the fact that when you're at your kid's diving competition, you're thinking about how to make the podcast better? you're not present. You're not watching her get that medal, right? Even though you're there. It's not the time, but it's your brain being rewired. But it startups, people that think that you can have it all, that you can have balance, I don't think it's remotely true. I don't know any wildly successful founder that has balance, but I know many that are there for family dinner.
All right, last question. We have 30 seconds. Best advice for a first-time founder?
I'll quickly do two. They're related. One, you have to give it 24 months. B2C, maybe you'll hit a magic viral loop if you're lucky on App Store. If it's sales-driven, it's going to take you like 8 to 10 months to get a good customer. And that customer is not going to be big enough to put food on your mouth. And it's not going to be enough feedback on your product to get it anywhere. So if you're lucky in 18 months, you'll have a really sellable product. You need a buffer. So you need 24 months. Almost everyone budgets about 10 to 12. So they run out of money. And more importantly, the team runs out of group commitment just when it's starting to happen again and again and again. So, and I tell this, especially the younger founders are like, well, I don't have enough money. I don't have debt. I don't have, cry me a river. Like the market doesn't care. We don't need any more business products, do we?
No. Nope.
There's enough. Like Google Docs is fine.
Yep.
Like whatever. Salesforce is great. No one needs another. The world will not end if your business product does not ship tomorrow. And the world says you need 24 months to not just develop a minimum sellable product, get it right, make enough mistakes, and sell enough of it to have a viable business. And if you can't find a way between chutzpah, your life savings, angels, Y Combinator, Salesforce Accelerator, whatever it is, if you can't find a way to do 21, just quit in B2B. You're not committed enough. And just as importantly, it's related to this. Even if you are committed for 24 months, my founder walked out the door after 10, right? And he was super talented, one of the most talented people I've ever worked with. All your founders need to be there for 24 months. So the related advice I have, and founders make all that, because we all get so excited about what we want to do, but founder conflict's like destructive. So if you don't have the right founder conflict, if they're not both committed for 24 months and they're not just bad arse, okay, they've got to be great. Just take 6 more months and find another co-founder. Do whatever you have to do. Stay at a law firm. Work in sales at a security company. Do whatever it takes. I know you're excited today, but take that extra 6 months to really find that great co-founder you want to work with a decade. It's not just the personal side. It's like that amazing group of folks in the beginning, more than one that are committed for 24 plus months. Your odds go up like 100x.
Jason, you're the man. Thanks so much for hanging out.
Thanks for the time.
Everyone should check out Sasser. Go to the conference. It's awesome. It's an amazing place. And thanks for listening.
All right. Rock and roll. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again to our friends at Salesforce Essentials for sponsoring The Journey. Our team at The Mission uses Salesforce Essentials every day. Salesforce makes the leading CRM, and they created Salesforce Essentials especially for small businesses. It combines sales and service tools in a single app to help you win customers and build your business. It's affordable, it's made for small businesses just like yours, and it includes in-app tutorials so you never get lost. Try it for free today. Visit salesforce.com/thejourney to start your free trial. Or click the link in our show notes. We love Salesforce Essentials, and you will too.